Welcome to the Sacred Body Podcast. My name is Stacey Ramsauer, and I'm your host. This is an ongoing conversation about the sacred nature of embodiment and the path toward greater fulfillment as humans. We approach this conversation from the lens of birth, food, intimacy, sex, and much more. I hope you enjoy, and I'm so glad you're here. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Sacred Body Podcast, wherein I interview Mia Califf. Just as a heads up, the audio quality was a little bit spotty during this conversation, so I ask for your patience in moments where it feels like a fairly long gap. And there's a moment in the intro when I talk about the two sides of the discussion around addiction, one side being focused on an understanding or an approach to addiction as a disease, and the other side of the argument, which considers addiction to be more an expression of a deep inner longing. And just to clarify, I am on the latter side of the argument. What I describe in the intro might be a little unclear. I hope you enjoy. Go. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. This episode of the Sacred Body Podcast, I have the pleasure of speaking to one of my teachers and a woman I admire greatly for her work in the world, Mia Califf. And Mia, I'm going to actually read, I don't know if review is the correct word, but something from your most recent book. And I had it all pulled up, and it seems to have left me here. So let me see if I can get it pulled up fairly quickly. This kind of description of the book and the work that you do, I just found to be very succinct and slightly more eloquent than what I can offer. It is just a gorgeous acknowledgement of the work that you do. And I think, especially in these days where we have, I think, really a steady increase of awareness about ancestral healing and kind of some people turning their attention to the subtler implications of addiction and seemingly uncontrollable behavior. I think there is a shift away from this notion of addiction being a kind of disease, which I'm on that side of things of the discussion. And so I'm just going to read this quickly if I can find it. Thanks for your patience, everybody. Here it is. It's from Nancy Eichhorn, who's the editor of Somatic Psychotherapy Today. And Nancy writes, "Our pre-birth and birth experiences create imprints, living memories that have physiological, emotional, and spiritual consequences that influence how we relate to the world and to ourselves. Thankfully, if we have challenging early experiences, they don't have to define our entire life, if we know what to look for and how to heal these early traumas. Dr. Mia Califf teaches readers how to discover events that challenged their trust, safety, and security within each developmental stage from the point of view of the inner child, starting with conception, and how to work with these internalized imprints stuck in the past in now maladaptive contexts so that they can heal." Lots of big words in there, but I think they're all really relevant. And it was actually in my doula training that your book, your first book, The Secret Life of Babies, was recommended. And it just blew my world open and led me to some deep healing of my own birth experience and adoption at 2 weeks of age. And I'm so grateful to have you here to speak in your words about the work that you do. And if you would like to kind of flesh out that introduction and let our listeners know who you are, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Stacy. So lovely to be with you. Just thinking as you were reading Nancy's endorsement of my book, just how still mind-blowing it is to me that so many of the people on this earth don't realize that we remember our early experiences. Mm. And, you know, you could see why. There are plenty of issues that we don't tend to, but I think of, you know, our life, even preconception, in the womb, during birth, even before we're verbal, is a big, long continuity of, like, the breath of our lives. And even our ancestral lives are living, you know, in the now. And so I just find myself deeply enchanted by decoding what's being spoken through a child when they're having trouble, or what's being spoken through a mother when she's having
You froze.
Oh, no, I realized I had to raise the bar for what I was doing in the world and somehow emulate the ethics and skills that he was portraying. And I'd been a chiropractor up until then, and a dancer and an athlete, and I had studied craniosacral therapy. And then I felt very strongly that pre-birth and birth was the next frontier for me. So I did everything I could to gather information and study with Ray a bit, and do a lot of my own healing, like you mentioned, and then just work with tons of families and continue to study with them.
Could you go back a little bit, and only because I know his name, talk a little bit about how you encountered Ray Castellino, because you cut out a little bit. I'm just closing some extra windows on my computer so that doesn't happen again. Thank you.
Okay. I had to adjust some things to you on my internet. That's why you saw me texting a little earlier. We're just maximizing contact here.
Exactly.
Ray Castellino is a former chiropractor and a craniosacral therapist and a polarity therapist, and I got introduced to his work while studying craniosacral therapy. And in very short, it's a tiny story, but it was a pivotal moment in my life. If it, now's a good time. Mm-hmm. A really wonderful acupuncturist was teaching a craniosacral course in Vancouver, where I used to live. And I had met her 3 years before that and found her really off-putting and really kind of cold, and her eyes were dark and beady, and she just left me feeling a little bit. 3 years later, I found out she was teaching a pediatrics craniosacral course that I really wanted to take, but I thought, oh, do I have to take it from her? Oh, wrestle with it. And then I finally decided to go and took a look at her, and I couldn't even recognize her. She was glowing, her eyes were bright, her skin was like the color of ripe apricots. Like, my colleagues and I looked at each other and we said, what happened to her? And when we sat around and introduced ourselves and said what we've been up to for the last few years, she said, oh, I've been studying and going through this therapy about what we remember from birth and before birth. And she'd had a memory of having the umbilical cord around her neck, and that she had died while trying to be born. And when she figured it out and was able to redo her birth in a way that allowed her to do it as her body would have wished for, without feeling asphyxiated, all her color returned and her joy and her ability to connect with people. And I just thought, I don't know what that is. I was 31. I don't know what that is. I've got to get that. That's how I met Ray Castellino. That was who she was studying with.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. I'm really touched by one thing that you said right at the beginning of your intro. So what you said was you're sort of amazed that we generally don't consider our pre-birth and birth experiences when considering kind of the trajectory of our lives and some of these elements of our character or personality or relationship dynamics that seem to be uncontrollable patterns. I mean, when I read your book, I think that many people would have this experience, but certainly personally, when I read your book, it was like, oh yes, of course. Of course this is what's going on, but there's no cultural context for that conversation. So I'm curious if your experience was similar, where it just felt very, very true, or if there was some process for buy-in and kind of what your experience has been with clients. Do people generally come to you in a similar way of just hearing about it and buying in 100%, or what is that process?
Yeah, I'd never thought about that before. I just thought back to the first moment I realized it mattered how we're born and how life is in the womb. I could say that I had never thought of it. Most people who come to me, and myself included initially, have been told something about their birth. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was the most beautiful day of my life, or oh, it took this many hours, or oh, you know, dad rushed me to the hospital, or my partner, da, da, da. Like, people get a really outside view, like a very distant camera angle of the story, and it's usually the mother's story. And when, you know, when a mom's giving birth, she's not exactly recording every detail. She's involved, right? And full of so many, if things are going well, full of so many strong opiates and natural hormones that she's not really meant to remember everything. So she may decide that it's okay to wind up and do it again. sometimes there's hospital records and people know certain procedures were done, but very few people have seen their hospital records. They just take their parents' word for it. Stunning number of people have never been told anything. So when I first remembered that birth mattered and I was interested, I felt like a veil had been pulled up from in front of my eyes. And I think that's the way a lot of people feel. It's shocking. And it's like you say, it makes sense. But it is a radical shift in depth perception. And I think that there is a natural amount of denial in our culture because so many people have had a hard go coming in one way or another that it's worth forgetting. In other words, their body did something that helped them survive so that they wouldn't have to live with some of those struggles in their consciousness. Mm-hmm. And you know, birthing practices like in hospitals for decades, certainly over 100 years, has had various themes of what doctors are willing to do to babies that hurt and scare them. And I don't know if many doctors, given the opportunity, would say, oh my gosh, what have I done? How can I make it up to you, all these children and others? But chances are the same was done to them. So they may think this is normal. Usually we pass on a birth that we think is normal. And if normal means commonly being hurt or drugged or assisted in some way that's maybe not medically necessary, this is what we'll turn to as far as, you know, a helping hand, as it were. So I think it is a radical moment and not everybody buys in right away. But, you know, some people have been struggling for a really long time with symptoms that they've had no understandable roots. So I think some people get a hold of this possibility for healing. They're like, oh my gosh, I just want to do as much as I can because this hasn't felt right. And I know it's not me. Yeah. It has to be something that happened to me.
Well, and I, speaking from American culture, but I think largely Western culture, there is this kind of driving need to just carry on, right? Like, pick yourself up by your bootstraps and move on. Just put your nose to the grindstone and move on. We're not a culture of healing. We're not a culture of deep vulnerability. There's a lot of fear in that. And as with, you know, anyone who enters into their own healing process, it naturally extends to their immediate family, if not extended family, and that can create a feeling of division or separateness, even if the relationship is not that strong, which I think also further scares people from going deep into the healing. And you mentioned that you work with a lot of families, and I'd love to hear what that looks like.
You're absolutely right. The division is a risk, and it happens. I would say 90% of mothers I've encountered have regrets when they discover that their baby was hurt through the process they were either naturally went through or were put through during the birth of their child. I would say that when confronted with the possibility that their child could heal and they could even heal and complete the birth that was interrupted in certain ways, I would say nearly as many of them want to do that. I've met very few mothers who, if given the opportunity, wouldn't want to then take that next step. However, I work with, you know, a really unique segment of the population who already would understand something like this. I'm not working with the general populace usually. But there is a lot of defensiveness. There is a lot of guilt. But, you know, I just have learned over the years to develop so much empathy for mothers, because I've learned how in a way vulnerable you are when you're in the birthing milieu because of all the natural chemicals that are going on, because your body is completely out of control. And really, I mean, you and your baby have everything it takes to do birth, but the people around you, in some ways you need protection from their agendas, their undigested pre-birth and birth experiences that can sort of steer birth. And you need advocates and people who not only know how to talk to you when you're in those tough places, and they're a guarantee in every birth. Never heard of a birth that didn't have one of those or two of those moments where an impasse was developing that needed negotiating, but you also need protection, someone else to protect the space, watch the door, not let people in who aren't invited, or mitigate questions so you don't have to come up out of your face and give your attention away from your body and your baby. But, I think that every parent I've known, both fathers and partners and mothers, have all been really interested in the possibilities because they love their children and they're seeing what their children are struggling with. They know they've struggled with certain similar things, and they see it in their children. And a lot of mothers actually have the intuition it's from the birth. So it's very rewarding to meet people in that deep intuitive place, the same one you had or I had when we went, oh, this really matters, I want to work on it. Parents are very similar.
And I think it at a certain point, we, any of us approaching any kind of healing practice, there is a certain point where we have to and understand that we can transcend the sort of blame guilt dynamic, which comes up so often, particularly in this arena of like what happened during birth. I know myself, being so close to the process and really having had what I consider to be a very sacred and beautiful process that I fought very hard for, there is still a little voice inside my head that's like, well, I wonder what could have happened if I just did this differently, or if I hadn't done this during my pregnancy, or, you know, XYZ, the endless trail of questions that come up of, could I have done more? And that continues through mothering. I know from every mother that I know, parenting, I should say, all parents constantly question themselves. And all of this is so intertwined. And what I really cherish about your work and that I think is so essential, and I want to talk about the Ayurvedic view of birth and conception too, because that's sort of my area of focus. But the title of your second book, Healing Can Happen at Any Time. And correct that if that's not totally accurate. And I just would love to hear you talk about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I'm thinking about right now is that cycle that all of us get into when something hasn't gone our way. I mean, every woman dreams of birth working out quite well for themselves. Some are afraid of certain outcomes, but you know, when I think, when you imagine giving birth, you imagine, most women imagine being able to keep up with it and being able to do it in that moment of meeting their child. And, you know, even if they're uneducated about birth or are gearing themselves up for the child, like they're going into it with some awareness, it's gonna be hard. But when any of us go through an experience that's overwhelming and it didn't go the way we wanted, we will look for what we could have done differently. And I think it's very similar to a child who's had trauma. Mm. Children like to think it was their fault when parents acted badly or caregivers or whatever adult mm-hmm. hurt them. It's this sense of not being able to really digest yet that something has happened. It's in a way, it's a griefless state. If we're able to come to accept that something's happened and really grieve our losses and feel how devastated we are by the disappointment, then the guilt actually settles down and it becomes something more like acceptance. It becomes regret, but it isn't a constant revisiting of the situation or the memory. It's like trauma. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to, like a birth, you know, a lot of women, I know a lot of women who have had like a natural birth, but say something happened right after birth where their baby and them had to be separated because she was either bleeding or, you know, that she had to go to the hospital for some reason. You know, there's a lot of different ways to get disappointed. And there's a lot of opportunities to feel surprised and overwhelmed or shocked in birth because it's so big. It's so big. And the chemicals are so big at the time that the imprints are very big. Mm-hmm. Because whatever happens at birth, whether you're the baby or the mom, it's really what works its way into you quite deeply because all the chemicals are there to fix it into you. And so I think guilt is understandable, and you're right, it's very common, but I think it's because the mom hasn't had a chance to really be held in a way where she gets to feel what her wishes would have been and be able to grieve what didn't happen. And then often what happens is, even if they're concerned for their baby or their now grown child, the child experiences change as soon as the mom gets to have those feelings mm-hmm. and taken in around them. And of course, you know, birth isn't ever finished if it's been interrupted. So if you've been someone who's had an epidural or forceps or a cesarean, or you were separated from your baby, those mental moments and trajectories are still waiting to complete mm-hmm. without the instruments or without the instruments. So if you can get a mother and a baby or parents together with a baby or child and keep holding space for them to complete the birth, they will. Mother's wombs will start up again and complete when there's been a cesarean, and the baby will come to the mother's body and move through the mother's body just like they a vaginal birth, and things change because of it. So I think all natural trajectories, whether it's, you know, the way the sun rises or the way a baby is born, they're all intact arcs in nature. And when we give space to anything that got in the way to come out and be grieved and held with compassion, that natural arc comes back into coherence and acts as though it was intact in the first place. It's pretty amazing.
And while there, you know, I think a lot about as a birth worker, how to invite folks into the birth field before the event of birth. And it's something, you know, that I'm connecting to a lot in the work that I offer, really was imprinted upon me through understanding how Ayurveda views birth and this sort of necessary karmic imprinting. There is a story to be told by not only this child, this being coming into flesh, but also the dynamic between that child and the mom, that child and the dad, that child and the world, the extended family. And I think that's one of the most important things to bring into the maybe even preconception conversation that's just not universally accepted very well because it seems so out there of like, your baby has a story to tell. They have a journey to take. And so much of birth is out of our control. And while it would be lovely for, there's a lot that we can do to mitigate some of these interruptions and interventions. And sometimes these are necessary thresholds for our overall healing.
I totally agree with you about there are some necessary learnings in life. I mean, back at least 7 years, and I can say I wouldn't be myself if I hadn't gone through all the healing I had to go through. And I've given a lot of thought, like, does that mean that every wound and every person who hurts us was an instrument of that? And therefore everything's in right relationship. I'm not sure if that's what you're saying. But I've grappled with it because I think there also is a place where human beings, when confronted with the opportunity to commit evil acts, what we're talking about is soul learning. Mm-hmm. And what does it take to learn a soul lesson? And is it necessary to be injured in order to learn a soul lesson?
Mm-hmm.
And what responsibility do we have as adults in regards to children in either allowing them to live through their lessons or preventing them from being hurt?
Mm-hmm.
And I've grappled a lot with it because if I look back over my last 47 years, I would say that I would not be the same person that I am today if I hadn't gone through the injuries that I've had. They've deepened and wisened my perspective and they give me something to offer people. And what the perspective does. But I can also say that those who hurt me could have stopped at the first time they did it. Mm-hmm. They didn't need to repeat it over and over again. And what we start to have to parse through is human evil acts. And I think each of us, as soon as we become aware that we could hurt someone, it's up to us to restrain ourselves. Because the definition of love is, I could hurt you and I won't.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you're in an argument with your partner and you feel like doing something terrible because you're so mad, you could say something or do something that would devastate that person. And if you really think about how much it would hurt them, love tells you not to do it. So what would it take for obstetricians to love mothers and babies so that they could see and ask, am I serving these two and the rest of their lives together? Or am I going to imprint them in such a way that's going to make it very hard for them to love what I did to them?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think, you know, a lot of obstetricians aren't aware and don't believe that babies have an experience, but we have to really take into account that we change the course of a person's future by how we treat them when they're young and impressionable in the womb and at birth. And so I'm not in agreement that every challenge that comes our way is a big picture of what's been planned or
mm-hmm.
deemed for mm-hmm. us. I think people mess up and do indulge and sometimes even enjoy hurting people, and that needs to stop.
Yes. Yes, I'm in agreement with you. And what I understand coming from this lesson about karma is there just are kind of certain areas of our life, whether it's belonging or whether it's self-expression, or, you know, all of these things are related. There are just certain trajectories that are set in motion with conception and with our birth process, and who our parents are, the two beings that have come together to create our existence, to bring our soul into incarnation. And there's something that you wrote, I believe it was in an article, and
the ideal cesarean birth.
No, it wasn't that, but I would love to hear about that. But it was about the family field model and how the family field model holds the possibility for healing across space and time. So how the child can be a reflection of what the ancestors need, essentially. So I'd love to hear you speak to that.
Well, I think in around 2007 was when I first started noticing that very, very elderly people started to come up in the conversation in treatment, and not living, not people that were in the room, and not people that were alive. But either I or the person I was working with would have an image of like a very white haired person. And I never like to lead people with suggestions, but I would just ask the question, is this person familiar to you? And 10 out of 10 times people would say, oh yeah, I'm thinking of my grandfather, I'm thinking of my great grandmother, I'm feeling like this is a woman from my ancestry. And that's when I started thinking about the family field, because as soon as we inquired what that person wanted or had to say or needed and gave them that energetically or with a visualization of some kind, not only would the person have an emotional release, but their symptoms would radically change in their body. And I started seeing these pictures of, they're very crude pictures, but of, you know, the organization of ancestry and how they figure into a child's conception and birth and life. And started realizing that, you know, we do share symptoms. We share, and those symptoms can digestive challenges or isn't coming into the world and just keeps incarnating only until 3 months gestation. You can start to inquire back and you'll find either large-scale events that happen to an entire generation of people or culture, or you can find very specific events that are pertaining to one member of that person's ancestry that are somehow playing out in the present and trying to be known and given empathy to for the first time through this child suffering. And I don't understand, you know, the mechanism of it, but I do enjoy working with the map of it and taking joy that at least a hope that the ancestors benefit from healing in the pre-birth and birth period or anything in life. So the family field is an exploration of how to include near and distant the healing process of any point in the timeline of life.
I love that. And what I also think of is how, and I'd love to hear you speak to this in the sense that we are living ancestors and there is something real being communicated through our DNA and through our cells, and there is a kind of living memory in our physicality and moving. You know, everyone has a womb imprint. So whether you're, you know, however you identify the gender of your body, there is, you know, a womb imprint that is kind of the portal. I think of that place as the portal and literally shapes us. And I'd love to hear you speak to anything that you've recognized or maybe explicitly work with as far as movement patterns and physical body expression, certainly with babies, but also adults.
Well, there are quite a few movement patterns to detect. They range from gestures that arise after birth, gestures of bonding, like mouthing movements, reaching movements towards the mother, slithering movements, which is the journey from the womb to the breast. There's, you know, a whole myriad of ways a baby can show you what they still want to do and how it went the first time they tried doing it. And, you know, with enough encouragement and awareness about what they're optimally trying to do, you can really guide them to complete something that might have gotten interrupted. And they'll also tell you where in the process they got interrupted, and they'll cry or get stuck. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because that journey on the outside is very, very similar to the journey through the birth canal and through the pelvis. So usually the way a baby bonds on the outside will mimic how they were able to travel through their mother's pelvis and out. And so you may be looking at layers. You may be seeing a baby who appears to be doing a mouthing reflex that's interrupted by frustration and cries, but they're also showing you what it was like the moment they were exiting the pelvis. Mm. So usually the end of any trajectory will match the end of the trajectory before it. So the moment of contact at the breast will mimic probably the moment of actually exiting the pelvis. And it takes a long time to kind of parse through all this. But then there's a whole series of gestures that come from the first month of pregnancy. And I go into them in quite a lot of detail in this recent book, It's Never Too Late, Healing Pre-Birth and Birth at Any Age. The way we are conceived will show up largely around our vertical axis, where our brain and spinal cord will eventually organize. And basically in yoga terms, the central channel, or how we let light through ourselves to the earth, what kind of downward and upward relationship we have between heaven and earth, and how we are suspended between those two atmospheres, will mimic a lot about what conception was like and how our parents were doing, and was this world ready for us? And kind of chemicals, if any, were present there, degrees of willingness. They'll all kind of shape our orientation to heaven and earth, our vertical. And then there's several others that happen at implantation, just like, you know, 4 to 9 days later, ideally. And then there are some more when we get discovered, that mom finds out she's pregnant, and, you know, how does she react? How does her partner react? Is there a partner? And what about the village and the family? So all of these things shape our orientation to space in our bodies, because we're really developing in a matrix that is multidimensional and held by other people, living and past. So we don't come in alone, even though it can feel like it sometimes. Mm-hmm. That's been woven for beginning of human time and earth time, and is most dramatically imprinted by our parents.
I wonder what you imagine to be the most beneficial way of supporting a birthing family. So a lot of my listeners are birth workers and or interested in birth. And as a doula myself, you know, the work has been dramatically altered by giving birth. In particular, like the things that you say or don't say to a birthing person, what's actually helpful. I got a real clear message that something I almost always said in birth was entirely inappropriate. But I would just love to hear your thoughts on some of the most important or beneficial ways to support a birthing family. And also for listeners who are just a family to solicit support.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a tall order, but I think doing your own pre-birth and birth healing is probably the best way to support birth. I think so many people who get into birth support are intrigued because they're also working out something in their own pre-birth and birth. Mm-hmm. And aren't we all? But, you know, like you say, I think that's like a very innocent version of what you might stop doing. Like, there's a lot of things
yes.
women and men do in the birth support world that can be not just a little bit distracting or annoying, but can actually railroad birth into a particular direction. Like one woman I was with at a birth, she would get really, really anxious that the birthing mom was going to be too cold if she was wet, if her hair was wet from the birthing pool. And it wasn't about water and it wasn't about being too wet, but it was her anxiety from her birth that she wasn't okay and her mom wasn't okay, that she was kind of sprinkling around the room a lot. And I noticed that it was, you know, I just noticed there was no emergency and there was no problem at the time, but she was really preempting one. And, you know, that can really start to, through mirror neurons and energetic fields and everything can start to make people nervous and increase heart rates and adrenaline and, you know. So I think doing your own work is fabulous. And if you can't, I think giving birth is incredible because you say, you know, it's from the inside out. But also if you can watch babies a lot and see, you know, see them as wise beings, see them as sentient beings that know exactly what they want. They know what's happening. They remember what's happening to them. If you could like imagine a non-materialist, non-scientific materialist world where all things are sentient, and start to trust that life is making life and nature is driving nature, respecting a woman's body, you know, these kinds of big things, cultural shifting things, that's a good paradigm to dip into as a support person. And then there's all the usuals, which are well taught, like quiet her atmosphere and make sure she's warm and, you know, all the things that settle the woman's nervous system down. I'm also thinking of, again, Ray Castellino and his therapeutic partner, Mary Jackson. They'll do three sessions with a family before the birth where they'll just talk with a couple and watch how they're interacting. And they'll try to notice what kinds of repetitive sentences or sort of breaks in their relationship when they're trying to communicate, and just sort of feel into what's at the heart of those little glitches in the arc of connection. And typically they do go pretty deep down into each of their early experiences. And so if that can be kind of sorted, then the partner becomes a really good birth support.
Yes, that's fabulous. There's so much, and something that you said earlier about not leading people when an image comes through, not leading people with your own, like, I think this is happening, but really that pure essential observation of relationship dynamic, body language, and asking a question. I think there's so much in the medical approach to birth that is just, this is how it is, and this is what we're going to do, and this is how we react, and this is, you know, what you can do leading up to it, that leaves no room for physiology or life force to be expressed. It leaves no room for the subtlety of intimate partnership and the dynamic that is, and what an alive thing that is, and how it literally shapes a person's body, which impacts how the baby can or cannot emerge. So much of my own birth experience, without kind of derailing us, I just want to mention that my birth support team, within a month, I went from having a midwife and my husband as my support to having three doulas, two midwives, and a student midwife. And I wouldn't have had it any other way. And it just so happens that all of my doulas are mothers, and had fought for their birth experiences and had healed their own birth experiences, as well as my midwife. And in that space of my birth, so much of what I now feel as success and pride and being supported had to do with the fact that I was just seen by people who had been there, who knew and revered the mystery of it the complexity of it and that I needed to do whatever I needed to do to bring my baby earthside. And, you know, I could weep for how rare an experience I know that to be on the part of families. You know, it was wild, it was scary, it was so overwhelming, and I am healing from it and enjoying that healing process because I felt totally supported. And just to take that into maybe a question or an offering for your own comments, we don't approach medical care. There is no context for medical care, which I think even midwifery care can feel like medical care, of like, this is what I know in my bones I need. Can you support me in that as my medical care provider? Right? Like, sometimes there are big questions and we need medical professionals to support us in a way, but with birth, like, I don't believe that to be a medical event unless it is. And when soliciting support, there's no context for, here's what I would like to happen, and are you the right person to support me in that? And I, you know, like I said, to be fair, I didn't get there until like week 39 of my pregnancy, but I got there, damn it, and thank goodness I did.
Well, it's interesting, like, maybe you could say what the criteria were. When did you know? Like, how did you know what you knew that made you say yes? What did you feel? What had happened? That
I felt, so I was being transferred to medical care by my home birth midwife because of a test result. And it came as a shock. So I felt shock that this test result meant that I couldn't birth at home. And I felt deep anxiety after having gone to the hospital and, like, quote unquote, consulted, basically just like going and being told by the obstetrician what my birth would be like. And the next 3 days I had just an incredible level of anxiety and a deep knowing that this is not how my birth is meant to be. This is not what needs to happen. And I'm not okay with this and I don't feel safe. And that really prompted me to ask the support team that I did have in place at that time for help and just continue asking questions. I'm lucky enough to have birth workers and midwives and mothers and intuitives in my immediate circle, people that I can go to who would just reflect back to me that I knew what I needed. And it was still really hard because I consider myself, you know, for lots of reasons, I like to follow the rules. I like to respect who is quote unquote in charge. And I do have this kind of vein of deferment, like, oh, surely my midwife knows better. So it was all this big learning when I realized that was going on, that I was deferring my power and the knowledge outside myself. I was like, wait a minute. I know better. I know what I need and I need to trust that. I'm lucky enough to have a partner who trusted me and who could help me make it happen.
How did you decide on the people that were added to the team? Were they coming recommended by people you already trusted, or did you meet them and say yes based on meeting them?
Both. So like I said, I had a pretty big team.
And I think you had a big size team. That's a dolphin size team.
Well, and I had thought at some point during third trimester, I had this image. It was actually during a course that I did with a teacher called the 64 Yoginis, and it's this beautiful tantric mantra, and it's 64 names of the goddess and all these expressions of feminine energy. And I was like, I need 64 doulas. I need every aspect of this energy represented and around me and circling and singing and ceremony. And there's, I mean, again, I could weep. Birth is not held as a ceremony anymore, or largely, you know.
Well, look how you invited it, though. I mean, what's striking and moving about you is you had an underlying, it sounds like, fear, like you're not safe, and you weren't about to feed yourself to a situation that you knew you had options for. And you're saying not every woman realizes she can fortify her birth experience with trust. But that's exactly what you did. You decided, no, I'm not going into that dark tunnel. I'm going into this widening piece of light, or I'm going into a place where my body feels like it's dropping and spreading, not into past. I'm going into a future that's designed by me. And I think that's the beauty of every woman who claims her birth, is she can tell that story to other women. And that's, I think that's the way to spread the word, is other women can hear that. They give, that may not be my concern, but I want this. Oh, I never thought I could ask for this. How would I design it? And then just having a list of resourced people who could show up when called. I mean, what a revolution that could be. Just, you know, a list of able and willing people in certain communities that could be called upon.
Yeah. And there's a friend and teacher of mine, Marin Green, who's a midwife and a birth educator, and she teaches on this a lot. Instead of coming up with the list of things we don't want, you know, the birth plan as just a list of things that we don't want to happen, creating a birth plan based on your deepest desires for your birth experience. And I find it amazing that most obstetricians have never seen a home birth, attended a home birth, an unmedicated birth, and most of the people I know have not either.
And you know, I think there are just human beings out there, whether they are like farmers or doctors or lawyers. There's some people, when you get around them, you just notice that you feel well.
Yeah.
And I've often thought, you know, it's just, I don't know what it is that makes a person feel trustworthy, but you just know it in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find someone who makes you feel that way, that's your person. And I sometimes don't worry too much about what person's background is or how they're trained. I just feel like if I feel my body dropping and opening, yes, then I want to work with them. Or if I find myself quiet in their quietness, I want to work with them. I want to be around them. And even the best of us who can be like well-intending, sometimes we're anxious about it. Even if we're like, you could check all the boxes about our training and our, you know, our philosophies on life and what we eat. It's just an unexplainable thing sometimes. So there is that factor. And I like being open to just the mystery of that. Like, why does that person make me feel relaxed? I don't know, but I do. I feel like I trust them. I think that's the key feeling to look for.
And that's so essential in the onward and upward trajectory, is because what you're describing is a deferment to the truth of your own body, mm-hmm, rather than an idea that I've constructed in my mind about how it should be or what it is, a judgment. Yeah. I love that. Thank you for that reminder.
Another mentor of mine, Andrew Feldmayer, says ideals are tyranny. The moment you try to fix, mm-hmm, your life to set up to how it should be, even if those are good things that you seek, you're all of a sudden dominating yourself and your body and your moments. And so true. And sometimes, like for example, I've been told if I'm to give birth, because I once had a surgery to remove a fibroid and they think my uterus wouldn't be able to withstand it. And I have spent years hoping to be pregnant and also hoping to find the doctor who would allow me to birth naturally in a hospital and just let me be. And, you know, I went around and I must have spoken to about 7 or 8 obstetricians so far. And the only one I found that was willing, it wasn't because she had this track record or it was a hospital I would dare step foot in or anything like that, but she just said, yeah, we would just probably let you do your thing. And she was trying to figure out for me how to make that experience work. She said, you know, even if it was after hours, that's when everybody goes home and you'd be left alone. Like, she just, there wasn't anything extraordinary, but she was just relaxing to me because she wasn't muddling. I wasn't having to fight for what I wanted. She was fighting for me. And, you know, there's just, I don't want to give birth in a hospital. I know that all sorts of things can happen that aren't going to happen at home. But, you know, I think there's a wisdom in, well, maybe I don't really want to risk the thing that they're telling me I would risk. And maybe I'll be able to relax more if I'm not even thinking about it, not tracking it. So you weep because you don't get to fulfill the ideal, which would be, oh, me and my baby could just go to sleep after in our own bed. We could just have all the women tend to us and just stay there. And it would just be one long, beautiful sound of soul. You know, it would just be an uninterrupted thing. But, you know, if I can just grieve my losses and just thank people who want to help me, and they're, even if in their ways I don't really always agree with, I might actually feel more supported anyways. There is some wisdom in medicine.
Absolutely. And I appreciate the reminder and the re-anchoring back into what I consider a very, very tantric perspective. There are no absolutes. There's nothing inherently good or inherently bad about the way nature expresses itself. And it's all in the way that we utilize it and relate to it. And these relationships are fundamental to ultimately healing. It's in the relationship.
Now, when we look back, everything makes perfect sense. But in the moment, anything we have planned is probably not going to have happened, and we're just going to be receiving surprises. So we might as well just, you know, roll with some things. Like, just be open. And I really agree with fighting for the birth you want. And I really agree with fighting for people who make you feel safe. I think that's not negotiable. Like, you should be able to have that right. And the birth you want is going to be different than the birth you think you're going to have, no matter what. Mm-hmm. I've never, like, have you ever met anyone who had the birth they had planned?
No, including myself. In spite of, you know, it was something that I'm sitting here feeling a tremendous amount of pride, and it was not at all what I expected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything that comes from the divine is a surprise.
Well, Mia, I would love for you to let people know where they can find you, how they can access your work. I personally love getting your newsletter. It's like, whenever it arrives in my inbox, I'm like, ooh, poetry. And really beautiful offerings that you have. If you would just give us that information as we close.
Sure. So people are welcome to come and work with me in a family setting or one-on-one. I now live on an island, so it's sort of a retreat style event where, you know, you're really much in nature, and we spend, you know, 7 or 8 hours working through a body of work that you're interested in completing, or that could be with your child. I'm also available on Skype and the phone for individual sessions. And then periodically, I will hold an intensive retreat called Hearing Our Song, where people can come and work out the same similar body of work that they want to work through, but do it with 7 or 6 other people at the same time. We do that over 4 days. And then I also teach another program that I'm in love with. It's called The Soul of Things. And what we're practicing is relational reality between us and our embryonic cells, us and nature, and us and our ancestors, and really widening the lens of all our relations, I suppose you could say. And that takes place also in this nature retreat. And so those are what I'm up to.
I'm looking forward to doing that retreat with you one of these days.
Thank you.
Well, Mia, thank you so much for your time, for your work in the world, and it's always a pleasure to be with you, and I just feel really honored that you made time for us today.
Oh, Stacey. I find your presence and ideas so stimulating and fruitful in conversation. So thank you for inviting me, and all the best to you and your listeners.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today on this episode of the Sacred Body Podcast. Please leave us a review if you have the time. Spread the word far and wide. Talk to you next time.